Welcome to the Pioneer Theater Podcast. I'm Matthew Ivan Bennett. Our November show is The Lifespan of a Fact by Jeremy Kara-Ken, David Morrell, and Gordon Farrell. It's based on a book by John DeGatta and Jim Fingal. The play is about an obsessive young editor hired to fact-check an essay about suicide. Besides being salient for its treatment of mental health, it's an important piece because we're living in a world where fact and fiction can be hard to separate. To wade into that topic, I sat down with Dr. Avery Holton. Dr. Holton is a vice president and clinical and translational research scholar in the Department of Communication at the University of Utah. His research focuses on the crossroads of digital and social media. He was a 2018 National Humanities Center Fellow and in 2014 was the Faculty Researcher of the Year. He's published over 60 articles, including a co-authored study about the Foxconn suicides in China. He joins us now to talk about facts, personal point of view, and the lives of both in our society. Okay, Avery Holton, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
I should say thank you for being with us again. We had technical difficulties the first time, so we're having this conversation for the second time.
That's great.
But thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
So the play we're about to produce, The Lifespan of a Fact at Pioneer, is thematically about the tension between fact and poetic truth, centered on the essay, What Happens There, by John DeGatta. I want to ask you, how do you personally navigate that tension, and how do you encourage your students to navigate the tension between reportage and the emotional use of writing to move people?
It's a great question, and it's one that we tackle every day now, especially with our students. The definition of what truth is has changed, and it's changed quickly in today's social and digital media environment, meaning agendas, an agenda setting, and pushing forward thoughts and ideas and even ideologies are conflated with what is true and what truth is today. So even in the face of facts that may say otherwise, people can present their agendas, their ideologies in social media spaces that make it difficult to discern what is true and is there a difference between truth and fact. And for students, they're already well-versed in the notion of bias in journalism, that despite journalists supposing to be objective or supposing to be unbiased, that there's always bias, that bias is inherent, and also objectivity can be quite difficult to really convey. So they have that already in their mindset. But the change now is, how do we take facts and make them connect better with the truth? How can we use facts to support truth? And how can we do that not necessarily without emotion, but in ways that are more trusted by the public or those who are going to see these truths? And it's difficult when people in high positions of power, for example, the president of the United States, often bend or blur the truth to fit a particular agenda, to cause a specific reaction. And even when called out as spreading misinformation or what we might call fake news, cast that aside and either say that words that don't fit or aren't in agreement with a particular ideology are simply fake or false, even when we have evidence or science to say otherwise.
That's something that happens in the play. The essayist John DeGatta changes the number of murder victims. I think he changes it from 31 to 34, and because he likes the rhythm of 34. But those type of changes matter.
Yeah, they matter. Small movements of the truth, small movements of the fact to fit a particular rhythm, to change an emotion, can have rippling effects, can have tremendous effects. And we see that every day play out on social media, where a small misplacement of a fact, whether it's the changing of a number, reconstructing what someone said, taking an interview and pulling out particular parts to match what someone is trying to put forward, we see it all the time. And for our students in particular, that's a difficult challenge, but one that they're meeting in a number of ways. So they're learning how to substantiate facts and claims, how to check those facts and claims to themselves, become fact checkers, not only on stories, but anytime they're on social media, and what they can do about it, how they can call out misinformation, information that's meant to deceive, or sometimes just erroneous information, because we all do make errors, journalists included, and how to call those out and how to own up to mistakes. The issue, though, is when one small change in a fact changes what is seen as truth among the public. In this case, if we're talking about the number of murder victims changing, the difference between 31 and 34 is substantial, right? We're talking about a 10% change. But the number itself can sound different and resonate differently with a public and can be shared differently and can convey more fear or can inflate a problem to a point that maybe it wasn't at before. So figuring out ways to actually change the way truth is perceived and to change it quickly on social media is one of the issues that students now are facing because, you know, Mark Twain said it at one point, but lies and rumors circulate much more quickly than fact and information. And that's even more so on social media, where we're not talking about a matter of days, hours, or minutes. We're talking about a matter of seconds to really catch misinformation or mistruths and to try to change those and to correct them.
How do you feel about the opinion section in general, and how has it complicated the job of journalists? By opinion section, I mean that part of the news that is aimed at persuading, not informing.
Sure. So we've had opinion sections in newspapers and magazines and television programs and radio programs for quite some time. And those typically have been labeled as such: letters to the editor, opinions from reporters, exposés that are written with a particular bias or slant to them. And labeling them is appropriate and provides particular cues to an audience so they know this will be an opinion piece. What's happened, though, is we've seen a shift, in particular on television programs, where if we take CNN, for example, which casts itself as a 24-hour news program, at any given point during the day or night, if you turn that channel on now, you're more likely to see a panel of individuals, some of them journalists, some of them politicians or experts in their area, talking about issues in an opinionated form, right? And so CNN may align itself more left, Fox News may align itself more right, and those opinions come out in the reporting, and in particular when you put multiple people in a group. So if one person has a bias or has a particular opinion that they're pushing, it's relatively easy to see that and to identify that. But when you have four, five, six people on a panel that are pushing that, suddenly that opinion feels like it's the truth. It feels like the majority. And yeah, that majority idea of an opinion can really change how the public perceives an issue. And we've seen a proliferation of journalism organizations, news organizations, but also journalists themselves sharing more and more opinion. And part of that stems from this early idea that social media was a space where individuals could connect with one another, could have democratic conversations, could be civil, could talk about their opinions. And journalists, if they were going to be in those spaces, needed to act similarly to the rest of the public. So in order to convey to the public that they aren't bots providing information, that they're actual live beings, and to connect and engage, journalists started embedding opinion in what they wrote, sometimes just in tweets, maybe not in their news stories, oftentimes on more personal platforms like Instagram, providing aspects of their life that included opinion. So we saw a blurring of the personal and the professional, and that's translated into the public sphere, where now the public is left to discern, well, what is true here and what is just opinion? And is the opinion that's being provided based in truth? Is it based in fact? Or is it based in something else? Is it based in that sort of emotional truth that we've talked about a little bit, wherein a journalist might be bending certain facts, leaving certain facts out, omitting truths to cast some weight behind the opinion that they're putting out there?
How do you think social media platforms have affected journalism in showcasing journalists as people and not as instruments of a media outlet, as it were?
Social media has had a profound effect on journalists and journalism as a profession. If we think back 15 years ago, when we really started to see news organizations not just going online but also trying to engage audiences online, there was a push for journalists to engage in open spaces, in public forums such as chat rooms or in comment sections after stories. And we quickly saw that those sections became areas for flaming comments, for pushing agendas, for trolling. And many news organizations have shut those off now. But where they still wrestle is social media spaces. So where can a journalist be an individual, a person who's not a journalist, who's separated from that professional role? And where do they always have to be a journalist? So if we look at Twitter as an example, most of what we see from journalists on Twitter has to do with the issues they're covering, other journalists, or that sort of siloed voice of journalists, that filter bubble that things move through. And we don't see quite as much personal information conveyed. And there are a lot of studies that have examined this, journalists posting professional headshots, professional bios, linking to other journalists, really talking about journalism in that space and rarely talking about themselves. And we see the same thing starting to happen on other social media platforms like Instagram and on Facebook, where journalists are protecting themselves and their families more often, putting up privacy blankets over accounts like that, using Instagram as an example, as a private-facing platform to share pictures with just family and friends rather than being publicly facing, often doing the same thing on Facebook. And some news organizations have encouraged that, or they've encouraged having multiple accounts. So perhaps having one personal and one professional account on a social media platform. And what that does is it signals to a journalist that, hey, I can never be offline. I am an ambient journalist. My job is not a 9-to-5 job or an 8-to-10 job or whatever those hours are. It's 24/7. And when I'm in these spaces, I always have to be on, not necessarily for news coverage, but in terms of responding to an audience, looking for potential trolling and harassment, worrying about how the coverage that I've put out there might be viewed by the public and interpreted, and if I'm going to have to respond to that. And we live in a globalized information economy now, so meaning information flows freely 24/7. There are no temporal or geographic bounds. So journalists who post something here online at 5 p.m., that may show up, that shows up a bit later across the globe, and they still have to respond to those individuals too. So broadly speaking, journalists now, when they decide to enter the field, or whether they've been in the field for 10 or 15 or 20 years, no longer have the personal autonomy that they used to have, meaning it's very difficult to set down a phone. In the past, journalists could set down the pen or close the laptop. That's no longer the case because they are expected oftentimes
to respond
to respond by the news organization or just the institution of journalism itself to be responsive and to also be on guard.
What upsides do you see to the growth of social media for journalists? Has it helped preserve fact and truth in any way? I saw an interview this last week with Ronan Farrow, who broke the news about Harvey Weinstein and a lot of the Me Too news. And he claims that NBC tried to shut down his investigation several times. Mm-hmm. And that it was only, I guess, his reputation and his ability to operate independently on social networks that allowed the story to go forward. What do you think about that?
So first, it's important to remember how many people are on social media now and how much time they spend. So we have 5 to 6 billion people globally spending roughly 18 to 20 billion hours a day on social media spaces. Journalists, much like entertainers or celebrities, often have larger or more connected audiences, whether they're a journalist working for a news organization with a particular set of standards to uphold, or an independent blogger or microblogger who's not working with the same barriers or the same restrictions as a news organization. They have well-connected audiences. And social media, one of the upsides, social media allows for the creation of communities around particular topics. So we can use hashtags. We can use geotags. There are a number of things that can be employed to help elevate voice for journalists. So in topics of sensitive coverage, where news organizations might be tempted to tamp down coverage, whether it's for institutional or financial purposes or protective purposes, journalists can make the decision now about where their integrity lies or where their motives lie. And if they're in spaces where they feel like they need more voice or a story needs amplification, social media is the space for that. Now, alternatively, if a journalist makes a mistake or if something is misrepresented, it can fly equally quickly and the journalist can be under fire. And in the case of stories like the Harvey Weinstein story, journalists have to make decisions, you know, have to decide what's more important, the organization that I'm working for or the institution of what journalism really stands for. And in that case and others that we've seen more recently, some journalists have chosen the institutions or the values of journalism over the organization. And that's a brave stand. It's one that can cause a lot of emotional trauma, but it's also one that can cost a journalist their job. And in some cases, we've seen that work out quite well, where a journalist has taken one story from one news organization and shared it through another with great success. And in other cases, we've seen it end careers or at least force journalists into different professions. But on the whole, social media can be a mechanism for positive change and community building around particular topics. And when we find communities in social media that are well-bounded around particular topics, they tend to rally for and with one another. So they can provide support. They can provide corrections for misinformation. They can provide deeper truths that we weren't aware of and sources for those truths. And again, elevate voice that really helps build a collective community around an issue. And in cases such as these, it brings them to the public attention when they might otherwise have been squashed 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah. What one or two issues are you most passionate about right now in the state of journalism?
Yeah, I think one big one that we've hit on that I'm really passionate about is identity and how journalists now identify themselves personally and professionally. And a lot of my research focuses specifically on how journalists navigate their individual selves, their personal selves, their private lives from the public eye and their public selves and their professional selves. And of course, journalists have struggled with this or at least wrestled with it for some time, but typically celebrity journalists, Walter Cronkite, you know, being in the public eye but having a private life. Now, thousands of journalists wrestle with that idea. In the United States now, there are roughly 35,000 employees working in journalism, editors, journalists, producers, publishers, and many of them have to work in multiple social media spaces and have to, on a daily basis, not only do their jobs and report on stories or edit those stories or make quick news judgments and decisions, but they also have to think about their families and their friends and their personal integrity. And because of social media, those questions have to be answered much more quickly, sometimes without the luxury of much thought or time to consider them. And what we're finding in our research, and this is research that's of journalists in the US, of journalists in Canada, of journalists in the UK, and journalists in Australia, is that journalists are looking for ways to disconnect from social media. That doesn't mean alienate social media or completely go dark on social media, but disconnect sometimes for a few hours a day. So a daily schedule where from 8 a.m. to noon, a journalist may decide, I'm not going to be on social media. sometimes for a week or a holiday break, or sometimes just particular channels, leaving Facebook but putting more focus on Instagram, or leaving Instagram and putting more focus on Twitter. And in doing so, through that disconnection, they're actually reconnecting and re-engaging and feeling less burnout on some social media channels.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that—
Do you think that unplugging also helps journalists trust themselves more? Because I would think that being on social media all the time ups the peer pressure that you might experience.
Yeah. If you're on social media and you're on there more often, you're encountering more people that are asking more of you, or you're feeling— – so there's a perception that when you're on social media that in order to be successful, that you have to be engaging and you have to receive engagement. You have to receive likes. You have to receive comments. You have to receive retweets and reshares and reposts and all those sort of things that give us a little boost when they happen. But also that the content, at least for journalists, that you're sharing is always going to be under the public eye, whether it's personal or professional. So by unplugging, journalists can reduce some of that anxiety, but they also might elevate it as well, right? The sort of fear of missing out. What's happening when I'm not in that space? What am I missing personally and professionally? Am I going to miss the breaking news story? Am I going to miss a source? And because we are in an environment now where news and information breaks and circulates in a matter of seconds, turning off is a risk. You know, unplugging is a risk, but the rewards cognitively and emotionally seem to be high for journalists if they're able to break away from that fear of missing out, which actually does dissipate. You know, research shows that dissipates somewhat the longer and more frequently anyone does that. But if they're able to make that disconnection, then when they are on social media, they can be more engaged and more in tune, not only with what's happening in social media spaces, but what's also happening in what we might call the real world, you know, the face-to-face interactions, how the public actually looks and feels and thinks close up. And journalists value that. Journalists are storytellers at heart, and stories come from face-to-face engagement, from people, from their voices, right? Hearing those voices. And sure, they can come through social media platforms. And we see people using Twitter more often to tell stories with threaded responses or Instagram stories. But the real stories and the real connections and sometimes even the real truths happen in those face-to-face settings.
Does anything worry you about on the topic of identity politics and the neutrality required in journalism? Say you're Ezra Klein, editor of Vox, and a story comes across your desk that is very damaging to ex-President Obama. Is there a question in his mind, do I not put this out because I know the Vox audience won't like this?
Yeah,
Do you worry about those types of things?
I do. I worry that we're seeing an exchange in journalism in some cases of truth for agenda, of truth for agenda that leads to economic gain. So if we're looking at the bottom line of economic sustainability through audience growth or audience sustainability, putting out information or casting information with a certain agenda, whether it's on the right or the left, is problematic. Because an exchange of agendas for truth not only misconstrues the truth but misleads the public. And the core value of journalism rails against that, is not to mislead the public, but instead is to inform and to inform truthfully. And we have seen an exchange of that. And part of that is through sort of the economic restraints that journalism has faced. And part of that is also through social media culpability. And by that, I mean journalists are held to a higher standard on social media for what information they report on. And they're quickly aligned with the right or the left in terms of politics, maybe not by themselves, but by the content and the perception of that content from the public. And when that happens, when we start to see this exchange of truth and identity and agenda, the lines, the professional lines, the professional values that have guided journalism become blurred. And that invites a number of new actors into the journalism process, which can be a very good thing for democratic discourse, but can also be a very negative thing when everyone becomes a journalist and everyone is an arbiter of the truth. Then it becomes unclear who to turn to in times of competing truths, in times of competing facts or interpretations. And on an individual level, for journalists who are really out there striving to promote traditional norms and values, to really do their journalistic job and duty, it's difficult when their identity is always under question or always under pressure based on an agenda that isn't one specifically guided by truth.
Final question. What's your advice to the layperson in separating fact from fiction?
I think it's a great question. It's one that I thought about even after our last interview. My advice starts off with self-reflection, knowing who you are. Knowing who you are not only in social media spaces and in online spaces, but also offline, and representing that version of yourself throughout. So I would encourage people to think about information that they post and interactions they have on social media, and to really reflect on why they may have those and why they may post the content that they post, and if they would do that in a face-to-face setting, in an offline setting. And if so, why? And if not, why? And how can they align the two? So in other words, I would encourage people not to live separate lives on social media and offline, but rather to align those so that they're congruent. And that really helps settle an individual identity. So if we can do that, that's one step. The second is recognizing that we're now bounded and connected as a community on social media. We're bounded and connected on Instagram. We're bounded and connected on Twitter. We're bounded and connected on Facebook and TikTok and Snapchat and all of these channels, unless we're completely dark. And if we're going to operate on those channels and we're going to try to be more authentic on those channels, we also have to be more truthful. And that means ourselves checking and verifying the information that we share. And it also means when we see something that's misinformation, or we see something that's meant to deceive, or we see something that our gut just tells us isn't right, to dig in deeper. And rather than mute the person sharing that, rather than just keep scrolling, to say something. And that's difficult. And we've probably all seen that, especially on Facebook or Twitter, where someone does call out misinformation or does call out misleading information. And suddenly they're swarmed and they're attacked. But we're also seeing a change, a slow change, one that I would argue is too slow, where the calling out of misinformation, the calling out of inflammatory content is becoming more acceptable on the end of the person who's posted that, but also their friends or their followers. And we're seeing a shift in trolling. Now, that doesn't mean that trolls aren't out there. They're out there. And they are dug in. But more people are supporting one another and calling out misinformation and mistruth. And that's one of the positive side effects, I would argue, of the political climate that we're in now. People inherently want the truth. They may not always provide the truth. They may not always call out mistruth. But inherently, they do want the truth. And these social media platforms allow for that connection. And if we can start to think about being authentic in these spaces, being decent human beings in these spaces, and being truthful in all regards in these spaces, then we can elevate what they're used for. We can elevate the utopian idea that we once had of these spaces, mm-hmm. that was civil, democratic discourse connecting globally. And we're far from that right now, but I would argue we have the opportunity to get closer.
Well, it sounds like you're saying it's a group effort. It's got to start with being authentic, and digging in deeper.
Yeah, and we can all – sometimes that's difficult. It's extremely difficult. But if we can be examples, if one person can be an example and we think about the connections we have in social media spaces and how many friends or followers we have that will see that, and we can do that over and over again, we can affect change. We can send a signal that we are going to be authentic, we're going to be decent, we're going to be truthful, and hopefully you'll join us in that pursuit.
Dr. Avery Holton, you've made me want to be better.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing this again. Thank you for listening to the Pioneer Theater Podcast for the Lifespan of a Fact. For tickets, call 801-581-6961 or visit our website, pioneertheater.org. The show runs November 1st to November 16th. The Lifespan of a Fact is sponsored by Zions Bank. Thanks are also due to Robert J. Nelson and the University of Utah hosting us here in their audio studio at the J. Willard Marriott Library. Our website, one more time, is pioneertheater.org.